Today's episode is brought to you by NordPass Business, a simple yet advanced tool that makes online activities easier and safer. With NordPass, no one keeps their business account passwords in a notebook or a file on their desktop. Nobody bothers their colleagues about credit card details while they're out on holiday either. That's because NordPass allows all company members to store, manage, and share credentials and sensitive information securely and easily. Beyond that, NordPass quickly identifies weak passwords, monitors data breaches, and gives you full control over who has access to company resources. And check this out. You can now enjoy 3 months of NordPass Business for free. For that, go to www.nordpass.com/Swisspreneur and use the code Swisspreneur.
One of the key challenges of being an entrepreneur is to focus. There are plenty of ideas out there and plenty of, you know, cool things that are interesting and perhaps even worthwhile, valuable to do, but you cannot do everything. You have to focus. Every day you have to say no to things which you really would like to do.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. If you enjoy listening to our show, make sure to follow the podcast and leave a rating. And now, here's your host, Sylvain.
Diego, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're the co-founder and former CEO at Got Courts, a social network for racket sports players, and also a marketplace for booking courts and coaches. Before we talk about your venture, I want to go back in time and start with your studies. You actually studied business administration and international management. And during your studies, you worked at the consultancy firm Namix, a very well-known story, a Swiss success story, so to speak. So how was it to witness this unfolding of that well-known Swiss story for you?
Namix was a great experience. When I joined Namix, of course, the dot-com bubble and the new economy sort of had already burst. I joined Namix as an intern in 2005. And it still had a lot of this entrepreneurial spirit and drive, though. Even as an intern, I was given a lot of responsibility and leeway in doing things. And I had the opportunity to really make a difference, my own projects, my own small projects that I could run. I was quite hands-on, getting things done, but also, of course, working with the web technology, which at the time was super cutting-edge, so to speak, right? Everybody wanted to have websites and web applications and intranets and, you know, email marketing was a new thing. And it was a great learning experience from that as well. And I had great leaders. I learned a lot from my managers there. It's still one of the people that I reported to there is still probably the best boss I ever had. I learned a tremendous amount from him as well about leadership. And it was overall a great experience.
Amazing. And then after your studies, you continued with consultancy. You started your career at Accenture. What were your most precious learning from that time at a different consultancy firm?
Yeah, very different. Namix and Accenture are very different. Accenture at the time when I joined had 250,000 employees worldwide, worked on large projects, large implementation projects for global companies. But I made this change quite consciously, even though I thrived at Namix and the culture there and the hands-on elements, I wanted to start my career by learning a bit more sophisticated approaches, which corporates have, right? They have, sometimes you can call it, it's complex, it's difficult, it's tiresome, but at the same time, they have sophistication as well and quality on the top level, of course. And I wanted to make sure that I don't miss out on the opportunity of learning that, because I believe it's easier to break down once you know how to do it in a complex and sophisticated manner, it's easier to break it down to more simplified approaches if you have less time or less resources, rather than the other way around. When you only know sort of the hustling way, it's more difficult to then make it more sophisticated and complex if you've never experienced that. So that's one of the main drivers why I joined Accenture. And it was, again, a great learning experience. I had the opportunity to work on, at the time, very prominent projects as well. It was the time after the financial crisis, and lots of banking projects were happening. I learned a lot about project management, about software development and software development processes and approaches. I also learned a lot about getting things done, delivering. Mm-hmm. Accenture, and I think still is, but certainly then, was very focused on delivering change to their customers and value to their customers, actual impact, actual change at the customer process or organization. And that was quite formative, I believe, to watch this.
That really seems to have shaped you. And then you actually did this transition, right, from larger complex structures to smaller structures.
Yes.
Because then eventually you started your own company after, you also 5 years at Hong Kong Aviation Company. And then you started GutCourts together with your co-founder, Cedric.
Yeah.
And I wonder, where does this entrepreneurial drive come from? Was starting or having your own company, was that always your goal? Or did you have any role models that inspired you to pursue that path? Where do you get the entrepreneurial spirit from?
No role models as such, or in my family, or where sometimes this can come from. But definitely the move to Hong Kong was part of that, let's say, development again back to something more entrepreneurial, let's say. It was a smaller company with 300 employees, and I had the opportunity to have a bit more direct impact than I would have had at Accenture within those quite large projects, where sometimes you feel like you're on a big cruise ship and you're sort of polishing one little doorknob to make it very, very shiny, but still it's sort of one doorknob in a big ship. Whereas in a smaller organization, you can have a bit more direct impact. And I wanted to use this opportunity in Hong Kong to have that. It's something that I realized as well about me, and maybe that's part of an entrepreneurial drive, is sort of self-efficacy, in German, Selbstwirksamkeit. Mm-hmm. I realize that I'm most motivated and most happy if I sense that I have self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what drove me towards, again, more entrepreneurial applications.
I guess this self-efficacy, that's something that you probably have much stronger in a small organization, right?
Of course, yes, because what you do has a much more direct impact upon what's happening, right? And then it's also this, drive of getting things done, or having real impact, delivering something, doing something, right? Because it produces experiences that you can, again, find motivation in. So when you do something, something happens, right? And maybe sometimes it's not so good, so you change, and then hopefully it will turn into the better. Maybe it's good from the beginning, but it produces feedback. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it turns into a success, and then it produces motivating feedback. And that is a circle, let's say, a virtuous circle that I like.
Let's talk about GutCourts. You joined the company in 2017, but the company has actually already been around since 2013. Mm-hmm. So where was the company when you joined in 2017? What was the current state of the company?
Yeah, the company was struggling a bit when I came on board. It was, of course, part of the reason why I was looked for, so to speak, or my position was open. There was pretty much only one person from the former team still around, at least as an employee. And the product was not stable. It had sort of regular downtimes. They recently launched an app which had really bad ratings on the App Store and very unhappy users. They did a bridge financing round, which gave it about 7 months runway when I joined. They had just hired a new CTO, Cedric, my co-founder, so to speak, in that moment. And he had started to build up a new engineering team, but everybody was new, right? And there was a lot of things that had to be put in place in terms of, you know, the financing, of course, the product had to be fixed, and the company had to be sort of rebuilt, right? We had to have processes, structures. I mean, not over the top, right? But there had to be something that sort of guided how we worked together. And so that was the first order of business, essentially. And yeah.
You know, from the outside, this seems to be a turnaround case and a lot of red flags, like just one member of the original team still around, bad reviews on the Apple and Google Play stores. What sort of motivated you to join the company despite all these challenges and potential things that were not as good or as they should be?
Well, of course, I knew more once I actually started to engage with the challenges. And I didn't understand all the details, of course, when I joined. But the challenge, of course, was part of what motivated me, because I wanted to be more entrepreneurial. So it gave me an opportunity to be that. But also I knew many of the people that were involved with God Courts at the time, be it in the board as shareholders or also Cedric, back from studies or from school. So I knew that I would get along well with the people, which is super critical. Yeah. And that motivated me. And then, of course, it was also the challenge that that motivated.
So great people, but also an interesting and challenging situation to solve at the end.
At the end, right? If everything is smooth sailing and everything sort of works, you know, there really isn't much that you're needed for, right? When it's when things are a bit more difficult that you also get an opportunity to, you know, apply yourself and make a difference.
A big challenge when I look at startups, you know, that basically have a history and some of the team members leave, etc. It is not always easy to sort of have a clean cap table or a clean structure to bring someone else in. Mm-hmm. How did you solve that? Because you want to have the incentives, you know, of sort of, hey, if I make this turnaround happen, I want to have the upside in terms of higher share value. But you also have other people that were already involved before that. How did you solve that?
Clearly, that is a challenge. And of course, that was a challenge for the board essentially to solve even prior to my joining. Yeah. There is no perfect solution. That has to be said. But I think they found, and I with them, an acceptable way of dealing with that. One has to also say that it's a difference if you do join something rather than something which is at zero. There were customers, there was revenue, there was a brand, there was a website and an application. So it's a different situation. You can also not expect to be in the same boat as someone who starts at zero, joining in that role. Having said that, emotionally and in the perspective of my actions, I very much had to be and act as a founder of the company.
Of course.
It was also expected from the outside world, from customers, from partners, from investors, that I would, you know, feel that way and act that way. And so I had to kind of get into that mindset.
I know you're probably not allowed to speak about details, but share-wise, were you close to like a co-founder starting a business, like double-digit share percentage? Or what was sort of the scope there for you joining later?
That is very difficult to do if you come in later. Right. I was well incentivized, but it was not comparable to if you had been an original founder.
Got it.
One thing to consider, maybe that's something for others who are contemplating something similar than what I did. It's very important to keep the tax implications in mind because there is only one time in the history of a company that you can get essentially founder shares, which in Switzerland you're able to sell at any moment tax-free. Yeah. Any shares that you're given later after this initial moment will sometimes or will under certain circumstances be looked at least partially as income, mm-hmm. and this will be taxable. So that is something to keep in mind. Something certainly that I understand better now than I did at the beginning. It's not that I regret it, but it's certainly something that I would recommend anybody to do the same thing, yeah. To look at and try to understand.
I highly second that. Been there, done that.
Okay.
It's a good and very valuable tip. Let's also talk about the market opportunity, what you actually did with GodQuartz. On one hand, you're a social network, but on the other hand, you're also classic software as a service and enabled, a SaaS-enabled marketplace, basically. So how do these two sides come together? That sounds like a lot in one product.
Indeed. And that was, of course, a challenge, right? It's easy to say, yeah, we do everything and we do everything great. Yeah. Usually that's really hard to pull off. And of course, was also a challenge for us. At the same time, the company was started, and also when I joined, and we continued to believe in that vision that at the end, it's about the player. We wanted to have the player in the focus of our attention and call the player our main customer. But on the way there, the venue, be it a private club or be it a, you know, commercially run sports center, was part of that delivery of value to the player.
Right.
And they, as we realized relatively early on before my time, were very poorly digitalized. And there really wasn't much to latch onto, let's say, with digital technology and our solutions. So we figured we had to find a way to help them first. So we built this SaaS in order for them to support their court management, as well as the rule implementation about who gets to do what when with digital technology, upon which then we built this marketplace for them to publish their offering to a marketplace where then third parties, players could book a court and come and play and pay for that. In order to enhance, let's say, the value that this inherently already brings, mm-hmm. we built social features on top of that. So we built a marketplace that included social features where you could find friends, you can communicate with other players, you could have a profile, you have your picture. And later on, we even created new businesses around that with competitions for players to directly engage with us. And this enhanced the marketplace and thus the value of the SaaS as well. So it became sort of a combined ecosystem with each part reinforcing the other parts.
And it sounds that you specifically started with the courts itself, you know, sort of with the supply and now with the demand with the users. That's how many platform businesses start, right? They often seem to bring both sides together, but actually they do focus heavily on one part. Was that also in the case in your startup where you said, hey, we heavily focus on the supply side first to get that right. And then we get the users basically automatically because we have a good supply.
Definitely. I mean, this has been a discussion in the company more in the early days, but probably many two-sided marketplaces, as they are known, have that discussion. Where is, you know, what comes first? Mm-hmm. Do I have to find the demand first to attract supply, or do I bring in supply to attract demand? For us, and in my opinion, probably for most, I would argue that it's best to start with supply. For us, it was even more important because once we got a new venue onto the SaaS, usually they would help us to onboard their own players that they already had a relationship to. Yeah. So the growth in users and demand essentially was augmented with every SaaS customer that we had. So not every player that was on the platform was originally sourced by us, basically, or attracted by us. So we had this sort of exponential effect in there. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, helped us a lot to attract a lot of users. And for us, that it was absolutely clear that we had to start with supply.
And how did you acquire the supply? Because I imagine I come from the gym world originally, so we had a very similar model back then. And, you know, many of them were very, okay, come over for a physical meeting. Mm. So the acquisition costs were not that attractive because, especially in the early days, it wasn't that easy to just close them because they were quite reluctant to join a digital product. Mm. How did you experience that?
It really depends on the phase, right? At the beginning, I think it really makes sense to essentially allow inefficiencies, to maybe indeed go there and experience what is their place like? You know, how do they work every day? Who are these people? What is, you know, how are they in a bit more than just about the problem that you're trying to solve? Really to learn more about your customers. But of course, at some point, you need to start to become more efficient, and you cannot, usually you cannot afford to spend that much time on a single deal since it's the unit economics just don't allow that. So then we started to, on the one hand, also educate our customers, right? We would help them with doing video calls and online demos. And of course, we would use technology to make it easier for them to, you know, participate in these kinds of experiences. And to be honest, an online demo is anyway better than sitting on a screen next to each other and looking at it. And we invested in online resources for help and really a good product also. I mean, at the end of the day, a good product and word of mouth is that's the best.
Yeah, fully agree. I also want to talk about your business model. You have multiple income streams, right? You have the SaaS offering for the courts itself, but then you also had revenue from the users, for example, through the competition. So which sort of part was more important for you in terms of percentage of total revenue?
Well, we started with SaaS. So that at the beginning, this was critical, right? Because it gives you subscription income, essentially, that gives you predictable cash flows. Then came this marketplace element, which was more lucrative and had more potential, at least in the markets that we were with a lot of private clubs that don't have huge budgets. It's not a classic B2B SaaS deal that you usually do. And then the most lucrative, though, of course, and also with most upside potential long term is clearly the competition space or the direct to consumer element, right? Yeah. Whether it's competitions or there could also be additional ideas about what to do with the customer. Subscriptions, of course, are always an option, although you do need to deliver substantial value for the customer to be willing to pay a subscription, as you know, many other apps, certainly in the sports area, have shown.
Yeah. So then that sort of shifted more from the you know, B2B SaaS revenue more towards the user revenue.
Yes, exactly. So it used to be about 50-50 okay. marketplace SaaS when this was sort of the only business lines or revenue streams that we had.
Yeah.
When we created this third revenue stream around competitions, events, we were also able to attract sponsors that helped to finance for that, as nice. Well as direct customer or user spend. And this doubled our revenue about in the first year. So suddenly this made 50% of the total revenue. So this was certainly a good business proposition.
Amazing. Another thing that startups often face is the importance of timing, right? And if you look at the market, there was a big rise of paddle tennis. Maybe it differentiates a bit depending on the market, but in general, paddle tennis was on the rise and getting more and more popular. Mm-hmm. In what way did that affect you as Scott Courts? Did you also feel this boom where people were suddenly crazy about paddle tennis and even more needed a platform like yours?
We felt it, yes. I mean, of course, we were aware of what's going on in our industry. We were in close contact with federations, with partners, with competitors as well, on friendly terms, of course. And there we saw the meteoric rise of paddle in Spain, which had already sort of been going on for a while, but then it really happened in the Nordics, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, in Benelux, Belgium, Netherlands. And I mean, it just exploded, right? You had new centers popping up every week, essentially. And within a short couple of years, Sweden, for example, built something like 4,000 courts, right? Within
That's
two
insane.
Or 3 years and attracted, you know, multiple millions of players. So this was obviously something that we noticed. At the same time, this did not happen in our markets. So we were mainly active in the DACH area. Yeah. And since when we started, paddle really wasn't a thing at all. The product was not really geared towards paddle particularly. It was compatible, let's say, but it was geared towards tennis, which is, you know, by far the dominant racket sports in our market. And so when Paddle happened, it was one of our competitors who ended up being then our buyer, who benefited most from that and who put them in a position to buy us. So in the end, yes, it did affect us in some way, although not perhaps as, you know, as.
How do you see the market then? You know, when you see, hey, Paddle is on the rise, like crazy growth, but it's not in your markets. Did it then suddenly sort of question your strategy and said, hey, we need to go to this market because that's where, you know, the music plays?
Absolutely. Of course, that then suddenly comes up, right? But there is path dependency as well. There is what you already have is there. You cannot start on a green field. Yeah. Plus also we did see future potential within the vertical, let's say, tennis that we were in. And so we decided to watch closely what's going on. And of course, let's say, be as ready as we can for when the time comes, because now it's here essentially, but at the time I was sure that Paddle would eventually come to Switzerland and Germany and Austria and the markets that were close to us. But at the same time, really focus. I mean, we talked a little bit about entrepreneurial spirit and everything. I think one of the key challenges of being an entrepreneur is to focus. There are plenty of ideas out there and plenty of, you know, cool things that are interesting and perhaps even worthwhile, valuable to do, but you cannot do everything. You have to focus every day. You have to say no to things which you really would like to do. And it's the same with Paddle and with many other things that we could have been doing also. And I think that's maybe a bit the challenge as well with trends, right? Because trends can be very present, very visible, and people will ask you about them. And at the same time, they're really in a circle only in certain areas. They're not mainstream yet. So you need to be very careful in finding the right point in time when it's time to jump on something and to then invest resources and take them away from other places, because resources are limited. If you do this, you don't do something else. Yeah. And for us, that point never came with respect to Paddle before we were then, we exited then to Playtomic.
Got it. You know, now looking back, it all makes sense. But I imagine when you're yourself in that situation, you also have investors. And I assume that they see things a bit differently and say, hey, there's this Paddle trend. Why are we not there? And what sort of helps you to, you know, stay on course and say, no, we don't do that yet. This is a trend, but we have to stay focused. Is it mainly gut feeling, or what led you to, you know, to stay course and not go all over the place and lose focus? Yeah.
I think that's one of the key jobs of a CEO, is to have those conversations, to be open to them as well. Like, you're not supposed to just, you know, brush them away. Not at all, actually, because there's, you know, serious questions that is justified to ask them. At the same time, it's the CEO's job to create that focus for the company, to create an environment where the team can have that focus and can, you know, have their heads down and work on moving us forward. Mm-hmm. And I give them, let's say, the space to do that in and to not be distracted by other things. So in these discussions, I think it's extremely important to have them fact-based, so not necessarily gut feel, but to really look at the facts. And, you know, the facts were that there was a couple of paddle courts and, you know, hundreds of tennis courts, and there was a couple of paddle players and, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of tennis players, which we at the time or often haven't even really been engaging with. So there was still so much potential, much closer to where we were at already, rather than something which just the data did not warrant substantial investment yet.
Fair point. And you also mentioned that you have been active internationally. So you then expanded out of Switzerland. You were a big player here in the DACH region. How did you start this internationalization process? What was sort of your playbook to build traction in a new market outside of Switzerland?
Mm-hmm. The playbook very much developed. So, of course, we at first tried just to kind of make it happen by itself. Essentially, we would just offer our product in euros and, you know, advertise in a, on a German domain and, maybe do a bit of email marketing and stuff like that. And that had some impact, but really internationalization usually is a bit more difficult as we then learned. And what we, I mean, we tried all kinds of things from cold calling to again, email and, you know, of course, always trying to use the most efficient possible way before moving on to more resource intensive approaches. What in the end worked was partnerships with federations, essentially, that wanted to bring great technology to their clubs. This helped to build trust in a market where the brand wasn't as well known yet as it was in Switzerland. And also a offering which is more compatible, let's say, with the market preferences. Not every market has the same price sensitivity or appreciates the same kind of offer structure as well. And we realized that, for example, for us in Germany, it was really a freemium model that was the key. So we essentially offered a stripped down version of the SaaS for free. And then you could purchase upgrades, so to speak. And if we would have, you know, developed the product further, if the exit wouldn't have happened, we would have really honed down in that as well and create the specific versions and so on.
And that seems so smart because you then actually get the user acquisition sort of partially for free to build the other revenue stream. Fantastic.
Because again, you know, this is when your neighbor has something, right? Then immediately you're paying a bit more attention. And the same thing happens, of course, within venues and with clubs. And if suddenly if you have players, you know, if you have demand for them, then of course that helps. Although it clearly, and we already touched upon that question, we did try once to basically buy users. I mean, buy in the sense of you do, you know, marketing spend and then they sign up and they download your app and so on. It just turned out to be, you know, way too expensive. I mean, it's essentially trying to drink the ocean. to do that, then that's extremely expensive to do, right? Other companies have tried that, and then they spent a lot of money on doing that. And I think this particular company I'm thinking of now still doesn't make money. So,
To sort of also build your brand, you know, I assume you probably had like a booking site then on the website of the courts or the app, etc. How did you also, you know, communicate your brand to then generate this sort of word of mouth or brand awareness that not only the users, but also, let's say, your local competitor sees on your website that you're actually using Got Courts? Did he do anything there to sort of create a bit of a loop?
For sure. For us, it was always clear that Got Courts is a brand in touch with the customer. As I said before, we wanted to put the player in the center and treat them as a customer. So we were never seeing ourselves as a SaaS company that sells essentially primarily to the club or to the venue. And then they do with our software, whatever they want essentially. And then we are sort of in the background. We wanted to be present with the customer. Also, of course, because we wanted to eventually benefit from that commercially. So we were always branding our interfaces with Got Courts, and also legally, sort of, we had a direct relationship with the user, which gave us, you know, the opportunity to interact and also commercially with the players.
Fantastic. And you mentioned the importance of partnerships, especially in Germany. How did you structure these partnerships with the federations to also then generate sales or win more courts as customers and users in the end?
Yeah, as I said before, they on the one hand, of course, it's their business model, right? Federations, to more or less degree, depending on which federation and so on, are making revenue by providing access to their customer base, essentially, to their players and clubs that are federated within their organization. So we're not the first, basically, to sort of want that from them, and they're quite happy to provide that for a fee, of course. And that's essentially also what we did. Although we always also tried to highlight, and I think we succeeded, to demonstrate the value that we also bring. So not just that we pay them so that they give us access, essentially, but that we also are it's in their interest essentially to help us get to their stakeholders. Yeah. And because it will make them more successful. And at the end of the day, as a federation, you want successful clubs because they are your customers and they are also the ones who are, you know, bringing the whole community of tennis or the other sports alive.
Absolutely. I imagine that the activation of such an offering can still be a challenge, right? Because you're not the only one that the federation pushes or offers. And, you know, sometimes you then pay an annual fee and you get listed on like a website. Hey, here are our partners. Click here to redeem the partner offer. But you also need some activation or to generate some buzz and hype around the offering that is actually also getting used and building traction.
Absolutely.
What worked well for you there to really build this traction in combination with the federations?
So what they generally do is they help you communicate. They allow you to be present on their website in some form. We had quite a nice web presence actually on one of the federations in Southern Germany. We had our own little area, so to speak, about club digitalization. So we were also trying to provide value through the content that we put there. So not only talk about our product, but also provide value with the advice and with the experience that we can give. We organized webinars together with them. This was especially critical, by the way, during COVID, because essentially you had lockdowns, you had no tennis being played. So our product was useless. No one was able to profit from it because no one used it, right? No tennis was being played. So we figured, what can we do to still be relevant and provide value even during these times? And of course, it was the time of Zoom calls and everybody was at home and trying to somehow still communicate and collaborate. And also there, many clubs, their players, but also the club representatives, also in the federation, were not that familiar with this type of working. Whereas we were super steeped, of course, in all the digital collaboration technology and had been using it in our daily lives all the time. So we thought, okay, why don't we do a webinar about, you know, how you do Zoom calls and how you use email systems such as MailChimp and so on. Cool. And we started to provide value that way. Yeah. And they helped us, you know, get the word out to their community, and we provided the webinar and the value.
So it really is about going the extra mile, standing out, and delivering value in the end for whoever you work for or who your customer is.
We also did events with them. They had tournaments. Mm-hmm. Then we were present at the tournament, did presentations around digitalization of clubs, also in other ways than simply the SaaS, the booking system, marketplace, selling to third parties, and so on. But clearly, yes, you have to activate. As with any marketing measure, right?
It's exactly
just to be there is not enough, right? Yeah. You have to activate.
Jori mentioned it in 2022, then something big happened. GotCourts got acquired, and it got acquired by Playtomic, your sort of competitor, so to speak. You have already been in touch before. They basically followed your journey, right? Did you also follow their journey to see how they are developing and what they are up to?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a handful of players within sort of a similar space in Europe, but also in the US. Mm-hmm. And we always had more or less regular contact with the founders of those other companies. On the one hand, to share notes. On the other hand, to see, what works in other places, what's going on. And at some point, the conversation between Playtomic and us, or the CEO of Playtomic, as well as one of the founders and me, turned into a bit more serious, let's say. And I really sensed that they could be interested to somehow join forces, right? Mm-hmm. Whether this was going to be, what kind of structure this deal would have was a bit uncertain at the time still. And then for us, that really kicked off a process that, at first, we sort of said no a little bit. We kind of, we're not so sure yet. I think we still have some goals to kick or some points to make by ourselves. Mm-hmm. But it also started the process of reflection around, okay, so how, like, what does this mean, an exit for us? Yeah. What do we want? How far do we think we are? because essentially you're also selling something, right? You're selling a company. It's a highly complex thing, but it's still a product essentially, right? Mm-hmm. It's still, you have a sale transaction, and what you're selling has a certain condition at that time when you're selling it, and certain attributes and the story around it and so on. And before you can tell it to someone else and convince someone else, you need to know it yourself and have clarity about what it is. And that as this process unfolded, we became convinced that it would be a good time. We had the right product, so to speak. We had mm-hmm. a company that was at a good point in time and a good condition to make a sale. And then we re-engaged with them. And relatively quickly, some key parameters were put in place, not in writing, but by handshake, essentially, that were convincing to really follow through with the process.
Mm-hmm. This decision to say, hey, we want to sell or we don't want to sell, that is a very big and also a very yes. important one. What was your perspective there? You know, I assume because they were active in the markets where Paddle was, you know, growing rapidly fast, that they had this faster growth. And then also, as you mentioned, the financial resources to eventually buy you. But was that also sort of the perspective where you said, hey, we are good here in our DACH region, in our DACH markets, but it will be more challenging or more difficult to expand beyond that? That you sort of said, hey, now would be a good time to sell because we have something valuable, but not sure how much further that we can or want to push this. What were sort of the discussions behind closed doors about that topic?
Yeah, of course, it's a difficult decision because once you start it, you don't know what the outcome will be, of course.
Right.
There may be nothing and there may be, you know, success. But you have to really try it in a serious way. You cannot, the person who ended up being our advisor on the transaction, he once told me there can be no tire kicking exercises. Right. And that he's absolutely right. Because during the process, you will disclose certain information, even though, you know, maybe obviously it's confidential, but, you know, somehow it always finds ways into places where it shouldn't be. And, you also talk to people about, you know, potentially wanting to sell. You burn opportunities if suddenly you pull back for, you know, reasons that are hard to understand. So you really need to be willing to go through with it. And not only you, actually something I realized along the way is it's not me that's selling the company. Of course, I had a stake and that I was, you know, about to sell, but there's lots of other shareholders and they need to be willing to sell the company. I was the one running the process, but in the end, it's the shareholders that sell the company. And so they also need convincing. And there needs to be a process around that. For me, it was you have different points in time of the life of a company where a sale is more probable or easier to explain. More probable to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have certain times, right? A bit more early, a bit later, and so on and so forth. Usually not when you're busy delivering on the targets that you've promised someone and they've given you money to achieve them. So it's more sort of at these stops, right? In between those different phases. Yeah. And I believed that we were a bit at one of those stops. We came out of COVID. It was a roller coaster with many challenges and definitely some downs, but overall it was an up. Overall, it boosted us. We grew revenues. We had new business lines with competition, God Courts League. And the decision really was, well, do we want to push it beyond where we are and get new funding? We were also break even because we were forced to break even during COVID in order to just really make sure that we weren't threatened in our existence. Mm-hmm. This was also a difficult push to make, but luckily we were able to, even though I would have liked it to be maybe a year or two later, it would have been easier. Mm-hmm. But, well, you play the hand you're dealt.
Right.
And so we pushed for that, and then we were breaking even, and that also gave us it just totally changes the mindset that you have, because you don't have your back against the wall. It's not that the power dynamics is totally different in a conversation, in a negotiation. And we sort of had the luxury to think about, well, what do we want to do? Do we want to sell? Do we want to grow based on our own sort of resources and the investment that we can produce our own? Or do we again want to go to the market? And of course, the market for investments wasn't great after COVID. It was still, everybody was quite hesitant. And even though valuations were high in 2021, which they are, I think, not anymore now. So of course, 2022 hadn't come around with Ukraine and all the challenges that have happened since. So it was still all quite positive, but the hangover from COVID hadn't dissipated. So fundraising wasn't so easy. So we said, well, a bit uncertain. Plus as well, I was sure from a strategic sense that we would eventually get into the turf of other players.
Of course, yeah.
And then it becomes a bit more difficult. And then it really becomes about, okay, how much access to capital do you have? And I wasn't quite sure that we would be the ones that would be able to raise certainly more than the others. Mm-hmm. It really had many, many different elements. It was the timing, valuations were good. We had, successes to show. We had a great presence in Switzerland. Our position in Switzerland was superb. The home market that we own, essentially. But we also had traction, demonstrable traction internationally that we believed or that we showed could be replicated again. We had a new revenue streams with the competition. So we believed we had a good proposition. We had a company that was interested. What we then did was try to find other companies that could also be interested, because you generally don't want to only negotiate with one party. So we launched a small, let's say, process to find some other interest. And in the end, I think we had 3 non-binding offers, even though the Playtomic one was clearly the preferred.
Why was it the preferred one? Because of the strategic fit, or also because of the price that they were willing to pay?
It was a combination of factors. I mean, not all the negotiations were pushed to the point where you were sure that this was now the optimum that was achievable within that given deal. So I can't say where the other deals would have ended.
Sure.
But the overall fit was simply the best. I mean, the strategic reason behind it, the fit among the people involved, of course, the valuation. And in the end, this was the best proposition.
Yep. And how long did the whole process take? From these first getting a bit more serious conversations until you actually had the deal signed and closed?
Let me think about this. So the first noise we heard from them about potentially doing something together was actually in 2020.
Okay.
Towards the end of 2020, yeah. When we initially said, not sure, we're not quite there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, in spring of 2021, it was actually quite a coincidence, because one of the founders of Playtomic, he was skiing in St. Moritz. And for some reason, I had him on the phone, or I called him. And he was telling me that he was in Switzerland. So I said, well, come by and visit us in Zurich. Yeah. This wasn't really planned. But then he sits in my office and we start talking about, why we weren't quite ready yet, and whether he would be prepared to, think about some changes in their offering, let's say. And he was, and we shook on it, and then we had a basis upon which to start the process. I believe this was in April.
Okay.
Then we took some time to get ready on our end with sort of the documents and finding an advisor that we wanted to work with. And that took until about the end of June, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then July, August, we really got all the documentation ready, the paperwork or the presentation, so to speak, that we wanted to send around, have a list of potentially interested buyers. And then it all really happened quite quickly in, you know, from September to we closed on the 23rd of December 2021.
Yeah, fantastic. And how did you come up with the right price to sell the valuation? Because that's a key aspect in the whole negotiation, right?
We had a view of where we felt our valuation was, or we had a view, less a number, more a metric or a way of calculating that we felt was accurately representing the business. And that's also what we agreed upon. So when we sat there in April, we agreed upon what would be the mechanism by which we achieve a valuation. And it depended upon some KPI, so to speak, revenue and so on. So these figures were only present later on when we had actually, you know, gone to the term sheet phase and so on and plugged in an actual number. And then actually we had to continuously justify that number as well, right? Because
of course,
reality still, you know, happens and, you know, KPIs are changing and essentially upon, you know, very late, you theoretically you have to be prepared to change it. Although through some very good management of the process and the negotiation process, essentially, we had a lot of stability within the agreements. There was very little sort of last minute surprises, you know, due diligence when the buyer suddenly says like, oh, but yeah, this is really a big problem. We now have to talk about the valuation. Yeah. In our case, I was very happy to be supported by a very competent advisor. I personally would recommend to anybody. Yes, they are very expensive, but to be honest, you know, ours at least, and they really have the potential to easily be worth more than what you pay them, because small changes can sometimes have a very, very big impact upon the valuation, the terms around it, right, as well, because the valuation isn't everything. You have earnout clauses, you have other things, you have lots and lots and lots of things that you can optimize or not optimize. And last but not least, deal certainty as well, right? Because you can have everything in place in terms of the numbers and the parameters, but if the deal doesn't happen, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So deal certainty, first and foremost, is very important. And, you know, delays kill deals. So to have something that helps you move forward, helps everybody involved move forward in a not necessarily hasty, but in a sort of a, like a tact, right? Like a rhythm. And that manages that, that's super valuable.
Absolutely. Did he then work with a multiple on your revenue to come up with the valuation? What was the mechanic behind it?
Yeah, in the end, it was mainly a revenue multiple.
Okay. How high was the multiple?
I cannot say.
Okay, fair point. Then you closed, but after you closed and sold the company, you still remained on board with Playtomic. Was that also part of the deal with the earnout that you just mentioned?
It wasn't really a requirement from the buyer side, actually, to my surprise a little bit. They never really brought it up as a must, essentially. Of course, they were saying, like, we'd like you to stay on, but it wasn't written down, essentially. But also for me, it wasn't a question of whether I wanted or whether I would or not. For me, it was clear that I would. And it wasn't really even about the earnout either. The earnout was structured in a way that had quite little risk and wasn't so dependent on me specifically being around. But it was more about, on the one hand, wanting to help them and sort of also, you know, bring this company that I helped to grow into good hands and help it be flourishing going forward. Also, you know, help the team to feel comfortable within this new situation, which of course is a huge change for the team, at least the way that we structured it, right? Where really sort of an absorption was the plan, right? It wasn't just an investment from the buyer. And And they had to face, you know, new realities, but also new opportunities. And I wanted to make sure that I support the team in finding new opportunities as well within the bigger context, because by the time Playtomic had already grown to about 200 people. So they were, you know, quite a sizable organization, growing like crazy. They had, I think the day after we closed, they announced the $50 million funding round. So, you know, there was quite some dynamism in there. And also for me, I felt like there could be potentially, you know, opportunities within the larger context. And at the beginning, I was also, besides having to continue to run God Courts, of course, and working on integration, I was also then helping Playtomic to do the market entry of their own product within the German-speaking market, plus some Eastern European countries. We called that Central Europe then, and building up, let's say, a team to help them grow in these markets. And I thought that was exciting. And so I stayed on for another while.
Amazing. I know you couldn't mention the multiple of the transaction. Can you give us a scope? Was it like 1, 2, or 3-digit million exit?
2-digit.
Perfect. That's already good for people, you know, to have a feeling. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. So if you look at, you know, where God Courts or then now with Playtomic is today, you currently connect more than 300,000 racket sports enthusiasts through your platform and just achieved the successful exit. What is next for you as a person now, Diego?
Yeah, of course, exciting. I'm a very curious person, so I always have a lot of things that interest me, probably more than you could realistically focus on. So the focus question, I, of course, also struggle on an individual level to keep. But of course, there is some things that I, let's say, pursue a bit more seriously than others. And one thing for sure is paddle. Paddle is coming to Switzerland and Germany and sort of our part of the world big time. People have really developed an interest in it and started to play. There is demand for it, far outstrips supply of where you can play it. Other people have realized that too. There's a lot of dynamism now within kind of creating new places where you can play paddle, and that's one of the projects that I'm currently engaged with. Hopefully more to announce fairly soon. But at the moment, still in the sort of finding and shaping phase. Something else that I'm very interested in, which of course is also a huge trend, but I actually have an interest in that since about 2002 when I was working for the exhibition of the ETH and the University of Zurich at the Expo 02, where they had ADA, the intelligent room, and it was a artificial intelligence neural network that they were exhibiting there, and I was sort of working there for a couple of months. And ever since, I've really been fascinated by the potential of artificial intelligence. And of course, now since ChatGPT, it's completely exploded also into the public sphere, let's say. I'm interested in AI a lot in the combination of life sciences. I believe it holds the potential to really be a game changer in the affordability of the best possible healthcare, as it can help to discover issues, essentially health issues, earlier, when it is cheaper to, you know, treat them or to perhaps even prevent a further deterioration or prevent it from actually even really sort of developing and turning into a problem. And as it the earlier catch something, the easier it is to usually treat it or fix it. And I think it holds a lot of potential there. It's something that, you know, sort of a visionary idea maybe, or just something that I currently explore a lot. Whether something will come of it, I don't know yet.
We'll make sure to closely follow your journey. There might be some good stuff happening there in the future.
Yeah. And lastly, you know, I of course, I'm interested a lot as well in other ventures, right? And what are other people doing? And I mean, there are so many good ideas out there, so many super talented people that are just working on such exciting things. And so I've also started to kind of become a little bit more interested as, you know, as an investor, as someone with other people to talk about, you know, what's going on in the space and potentially who has, you know, valuable propositions. So that's a third area that I'm sort of exploring loosely.
Fantastic. Diego, to wrap up the conversation today, we have prepared some rapid fire questions for you. I give either a short question or different options to choose from, and you have to ideally answer in one sentence.
Right.
You ready?
Let's try.
Let's go. What's your favorite racket sport?
Oh, difficult one at the beginning.
It right might be now, changing, you know?
Exactly. So right now, for me personally, it's paddle. Yeah. But of course, tennis is also in my heart.
Both go hand in hand to a certain degree. What does money mean to you?
Money is flexibility, independence. It's comfort, essentially, that you can, that you have more freedom to do what you, what motivates you. Yeah. Follow your curiosity is easier.
Nice. If you had to choose founder, CEO, or investor of a company?
That's a difficult one. Not investor, mm-hmm. Probably founder.
Yeah. What sports record of yourself are you most proud of?
Not many records, let's say, but I ran a marathon once in Zurich in 2016, and I think my time was 3:50 or so. It's the only marathon, so it's already a record.
That's perfect. You did it, you know, and it's a good time.
It was a great experience.
Yeah. Yeah. How many hours of sleep did you get last night?
Last night, 6.5.
Perfect. Have you ever regretted selling Got Courts?
Selling Got Courts? No, not at all. No, I think it was actually, I can't imagine many ways it could have gone better.
Perfect. Diego, thank you so much for coming on the show. Lots of success with whatever you're building next, and we make sure to closely follow you from the sidelines.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.